Good afternoon, everybody. I would like to welcome you to the symposium called Agricultural Remote Sensing with UAVs, Challenges and Opportunities. And this session is being live streamed, so later on, if you ask questions, please use a microphone. I also have to announce that the second speaker from the Federal Aviation Authority, FAA, could neither not attend. So our first speaker, Josh Braungart, he's going to try to cover two sessions. He will just give a bit more detailed explanations, and we can then also have a bit more time for discussions. So I would like to actually introduce Josh. He studied at Kansas State University and works now for Paradigm, and he's director of aviation. And Paradigm is a company that deals with data management and remote sensing, and I think we will learn more from Josh, like exactly what he's doing and also how they can contribute to this session. So thank you.
Thank you, Urs. As Urs mentioned, Paradigm is, I'll give you a quick overview since I've got a lot of time to fill now. Paradigm is a remote sensing company. We deal, I was the director of Kansas State University's program, UAS program, Unmanned Aircraft Systems, for 3 years, and then formed a company called Paradigm ISR. We deal with Oregon State University, multiple universities in the Northwest, getting the certificates to legally fly unmanned aerial vehicles for public universities and other entities throughout the Northwest. So, just get right into the slides here. So what are UAVs? Unmanned aerial vehicles, or you'll also hear the term UAS, unmanned aerial systems, because it is a complete system. It's not just the vehicle itself. It's not like when you get on an airplane, you don't think about everybody else, the fuel person, the handlers, baggage handlers, the stewardesses. It's all a complete system. And well, in unmanned systems, it is not just the aircraft, it's the computer, it's the command and controls, it's the launching systems if required, the landing systems, and so forth. They're also known in later years as drones. I have a pet peeve on that, and so hence the next slide. Drones classically have been targets. The military classified a drone as something that is unmanned but shot at. So I try to stay away from the term drones, but in popular media it has been termed drones lately, so I'll try not to use it, but we'll see. So what are unmanned vehicles good for? Unmanned aerial vehicles are good for basically what we call the three Ds, dirty, dull, and dangerous. Dirty, a good example of a dirty mission for an unmanned vehicle would be a nuclear power plant explosion, something that could cause harm both health and otherwise. Dull might be flying over agriculture crops to get images for 10 hours a day, or flying power lines, inspecting power lines for 12 hours a day. Dangerous, of course, we've seen a lot of use in the dangerous side on the Department of Defense for military applications in the Predator and Reaper and smaller size UAVs. So, perceptions. And a lot of what I'm going to talk about today really deals with, as most of you are researchers, field agronomists and so forth, crop consultants, is what is really legal in the eyes of the FAA and how can we play within this environment in between where the national airspace is being integrated at this point, and the FAA has kind of some gray areas that they're working through. So the perceptions. I had a video on here. Unfortunately, we don't have internet connection. What this video was a story on one of the news agencies, CNN, Fox, what have you, that was about the EPA using drones. This was 3 years ago. The EPA using drones in Nebraska to inspect cattle operations. That came out, caused a big storm within the unmanned world. A week later, Washington Post comes out and actually, it wasn't true. It never actually happened. The EPA has never used unmanned vehicles to do inspections of certain sorts. They have used manned aircraft to do those inspections. They use them in mining, not only in agriculture, but construction as well. So some of the other perceptions. the drone staring in the window. This is a big one that we fight almost every day. We operate in a pretty benign environment in the agriculture arena. You know, there's not a lot of people to hit. There's not a lot of windows to stare in or things like that. So one of the big things is the size of the UAVs. We have seen cases in New York City and in Seattle, where quadcopters have went up to windows. They may not have been looking in the window, but just flying by a window in skyscrapers. They're few and far between, but it does happen. And that's where I think the perception is really more of the intended use. So we're seeing a lot come through in state legislature right now for laws or authorities for what unmanned vehicles can do. And it shouldn't be necessarily the vehicle or the operation. It should be the intent of use of the vehicle and how that data is used. What can you use it for? Can a policeman use that data from, be it imagery or whatever, signature intelligence, flying over a house to go look at another place chasing a suspect and he finds a marijuana grow operation? We don't know. So that's where a lot of that legislation you're seeing happening. The navigation systems. A lot of these are systems in the lower end. On DoD realm, you know, we're talking aircraft that are 55 pounds and above, cost more than $250,000 a piece, have navigation systems that can go unaided. So they can lose GPS signal, and perhaps they can't. We saw this when Iran took control of one of our most sophisticated unmanned vehicles. They spoofed a GPS signal and thought, so it landed in the desert, thought it was supposed to be where it was. So the navigational systems, as I mentioned in New York City, one of those unmanned vehicles looking in a window or flying by the skyscrapers had GPS interference, basically reflectance of the GPS signal off of all the multiple buildings, ended up crashing into one, fell to the ground, and almost hit somebody on the street. The noise. I'm sure you've been around airplanes, especially propeller airplanes. They're very noisy. Even though a lot of these vehicles are electric vehicles, they do make quite a bit of noise. The last one I wanted to get into is the Freedom of Information Act. As some of you are with universities, there are multiple FOIA requests from the FAA, petition to the FAA. One of those is, I would just caution everyone, because when we see these FOIA requests come out and we see the universities, the public agencies that are using these, they can withhold information on this as well because of proprietary, whether it be checklist systems, whether it be safety issues. As a police department, you could say, well, because this has how I'm going to use the UAV, I can legally withhold that information from the FOIA request. And so, and this is a good thing. I'm not trying to frame this as a bad thing. I'm just saying, at a university, you want to make sure that you're doing this right, so that way you're not seeing somebody with a GPS jammer or somebody else coming out and trying to sabotage your research and what you're trying to do. There's a company in Oregon right now that's whole feasibility is GPS jamming and tracking UAVs. To be able to cause harm, and some of the legislation we've seen lately, within Oregon, takes this into effect. It's basically like shooting at an aircraft, a manned aircraft. So these are things that we have to watch out for. So now is kind of a period of transition. We've seen this, the proliferation of UAVs come forth quite fast. That's a lot of it's due to the low cost of systems. Right now you can go out and get a DJI Phantom for a couple $100 to $500 and stick a GoPro camera on it and have your own UAV. So what we're seeing is in the public sector is a lot. In Oregon, some of the research we do, I'm also a courtesy faculty at Oregon State University, so we've put together a lot of research programs in search and rescue. We have, as I'm sure you've seen, Mount Hood rescues all the time off Mount Hood, within the forest in Oregon, all over. So we do quite a bit with search and rescue. Some of the civil roles, as I just mentioned, search and rescue, agriculture, AUVSI, Association of Vehicle Systems International, the largest unmanned vehicle association in the U.S. and around the world, has put some numbers, which I think you may hear later, around how big the market is for agriculture. It's in the multi billions of dollars. Forestry. We have programs, research programs, not only Christmas tree farms, just counting and keeping track of inventory within the tree farms themselves, but large row crops for pulp, specifically poplar pulp. Mining efforts. As the sensors for these systems get smaller and smaller and better, we're seeing new markets unfold. You know, when we're looking at mining, unlike agriculture, where we're usually looking at multispectral, NDVI, things like that, red edge. In mining, we're usually looking in the hyper world, maybe even the square world, to identify minerals and things. As these sensors get smaller and smaller and are able to get on smaller UAVs, we're going to see that market open even more as well. In logistics, we've already seen this with Amazon. And there's others that are talking about delivering packages now. When I was at Kansas State, one of the largest packaging delivery companies in the world came to us and talked about one of their Boeing airplanes to be turned unmanned to fly in between Hawaii and LA, and what that might cost them in furtherance of their program. So it's coming. I don't think we'll see it anytime soon, even though we all get on unmanned vehicles, or most of us get on unmanned vehicles today. Go to Dallas-Fort Worth Airport. The train you get on is unmanned in between terminals. There's somebody there watching the system to make sure all the trains do what they're supposed to do, but that's about it. And this is really what we're talking about, cooperative systems. Some of the other roles in search and rescue. This was one that really kind of hit hard on me because we, at Kansas State, we tried to pull an effort together to take unmanned vehicles down to Haiti during the disaster down there because it never really made a whole lot of news, but there was a lot of victims actually found with their cell phones in the rubble. The complete infrastructure, the whole cell phone system within Haiti at that point went down. And so who knows how many victims could have been saved if we could have sent a UAV up as a surrogate for a cell phone tower, a repeater system, if you will. So there's multiple uses. In Oregon, we see this a lot with the canyons that we have. There's a lot of places that sheriff's departments and the state troopers don't even want to go because they have no connectivity to be able to get any help if they need it. So for them to be able to throw a UAV up as a cell phone repeater, as a radio repeater, has countless possibilities. So now we'll move on to agriculture. Some of the things, UC Davis is using unmanned helicopters and spraying pesticides. Where this has helped quite a bit is to really use the wind of the blades, the rotors, to wash the pesticide under the leaf as well. It's hilly, it's dangerous, so that's one of the reasons they're getting into the unmanned helicopter world. But the helicopters that they're flying are rather big. They're 200-pound helicopters that require quite a bit of operator and logistics support. It was back in 2010, one of the generals for the Air Force told me, I wouldn't see another generation of fighter pilots. The next fighter pilots would all be unmanned, so they'd be remotely piloted. One of the things that we questioned back in this discussion was how many people it takes to launch a Predator UAV versus how many people it takes to launch an F-16. And the numbers are rough, but basically it takes about 15 people to launch an F-16. It takes 80 people to launch a Predator unmanned aircraft, dealing with the comms and everything else that go along with it. Some of the research at Kansas State University is not only in the unmanned vehicles themselves, but in the application of sensors. And some of the speakers beyond me will talk about this a little bit more. One of the research projects we did in cooperation with USDA, Boeing, and Oregon State University this year was to fly over potato fields. We flew over an extension agency and a large grower operation out there almost every day we could. And we're talking on a 168-acre pivot. We were pulling upwards of 4,000 images at 10 megapixels each. and the data processing size that comes with that is just immense. So there's levels that we're going to see where the data will start to transition with the sensors themselves. So into the regulations now. So what are UAVs and why are they so restrictive? Commercial aircraft operations. Could you imagine what would happen if one of these hits an airliner? It's not a good day for any of us. Certification of the equipment to ensure public safety. When you jump on an airliner today, every part of that equipment, down to the seat cushions and so forth, has been certified for whatever aspect it may fall, whether that be HERF testing or fireproof or EMI testing or whatever. UAVs, beyond DOD, or I'll say the civil sector of UAVs in the unmanned hobbyist world or around there, or even for university work, have basically nothing that's certified on them. You're taking a open source autopilot system, hoping it works at 2.4 gigahertz with my 5.8 gigahertz video system, and hope something doesn't get messed up. So that's one of the reasons for the certification. Pilot standards. What we're going to see over the next year is standards for what do we have to have? Do we have to have a private pilot certificate? Do we have to have a commercial certificate to operate these in a commercial or higher world? So the Modernization Act, FAA Modernization Act 2012, Congress mandated the FAA must develop a safety plan and accelerate that. And so why is it so hard? Simple answer, sense and avoid. There is no person in the unmanned vehicle to avoid an object or another aircraft in the sky. So when people talk about autonomy levels of unmanned vehicles, we're still at a very low autonomy level. We're about midway through their autonomy. They can launch themselves, they can come back and land themselves, but they can't make any decisions and they can't decide whether to take evasive maneuvers or what it is they need to do. So what is that? As in an ag world, as an aerial applicator comes by and says, well, why can't I just put something in my aircraft that basically fries the autopilot within the UAV once I get within 1,000 feet of it, and then it just falls to the ground? Well, it's great until you get that piece of equipment in the hands of the wrong person. So what are the laws? What is the UAV in the FAA's eyes? There's basically three things to this. The first one is not as big of a point with the FAA anymore, but if it's intended to fly as a UAV, so meaning it has an autopilot system, if it auto lands, if it auto takeoffs, and so forth. Its operation is for business purpose. When I say business purpose, this is even, I'll get into some of the crop consultant and that here in just a little bit, but are you taking money for services rendered? Are you taking money for the pictures that you took of that house that you're selling for your real estate office? That's a higher operation. And then finally, beyond the guidelines set forth by the FAA and an advisory circular for the hobbyists that have been around for quite a while, are you flying it beyond line of sight? Does it weigh more than this, than the limit? Is it close? Is it within 5 miles of an airport? Things like that. Are you at an American Modelers Association field with insurance liability coverage? So how do we fly as a public agency? For a state university or a police department or so forth, it's through certificates of authorization. Now the FAA will come back and say, as a university, you are a public agency. So no matter what you fly, if it's for a hobbyist, you go out to the AMA field and you fly your model aircraft as a representative or a part of that university, it is now classified as a public aircraft. Same reason that police can't go out and just use unmanned vehicles without a certificate of authorization, a COA. They're not doing it for hire, but they are a public agency at that point. So a COA is administered by the FAA. It's basically an exemption that gives you the authorization. Allows for operations in a small area. Depending on the operation, there are caveats to this. Under strict flight guidelines, they'll tell you if you can auto land, if you can't, what your systems are going to be, and so forth. And a lot of these take three months to 2 years to obtain. It just depends on the level of system familiarity that you are and with your documentation. I've written a couple hundred COAs, so a lot of my university COAs go through in a couple of weeks. That's been pushed back a little bit because of the new test sites, which I'll go into here in just a little bit. But as I'm sure some of you researchers have seen, it can take quite a while. So how to get one? First off, you have to be blessed as a public agency. I say blessed because it is kind of a term of endearment from the FAA. It's a public agency, basically as a state university or so forth. You have to go out to have the state attorney general sign a declaration saying that you are a public agency, that the aircrafts you'll be flying are public aircraft. So, for example, my company Paradigm, we own UAVs, but we lease them to the universities for them to be able to fly those UAVs. So a lot of universities come up with programs with vendors that will be, a very minimum fee for at least a 90-day lease is what's classified under the definition of a public aircraft. Once that happens, which usually takes a couple months to get that through FAA's legal, then you get a COA online account. Through this online account, that's where you'll start to enter all the information, such as your systems and so forth, into the online packet. And those online packets, every submittal, that was what I was referring to in the previous slide, can take anywhere from a couple months to years. In the populated packet, your operating procedures are a big one. So how are you going to operate the aircraft? What can you do with the aircraft? This is a big one that the FAA actually a couple months ago sent a letter to the universities that it used to be you could submit a COA for applications. What I mean by that is you could submit it for, I want to look at nitrogen deficiencies in potatoes, or I want to look at using enhanced NDVI over soy. Can't do that anymore. As of a couple months ago, the FAA came out and said, we're no longer going to accept applications. It's all going to be on aerodynamic purposes, so flight tests. So you have to introduce a new vehicle, maybe it might be, or a new prop that you're going to have on the aircraft. That's the purpose of the COA. So then geographical areas. Now you have to go into, in there, very defined areas where you can and can't fly this aircraft. And when I say areas, you can actually have more than one area in a COA. So, for example, if I have fields in the northwest part of the state and I have some over at my extension center over in the middle part of the state, I can actually submit one COA for all those areas that I want to submit. Now, what goes into those, the ATC will actually say yes or no, depending on which airspace you're in and so forth. So a great question I had earlier was before, you know, what are the rules when it comes to flying within certain airspaces such as Class Bravo, which would be very busy airports, or versus Class Delta, which is a towered airport. It just changes the level of scrutiny of both the requirements of the pilots, requirements of what you can and can't do as far as height and altitude and so forth. The aircraft systems, very detailed documentation needs to go into the COA about your aircraft systems, how it's going to work, what are its fail safes, what happens if it loses GPS, what happens if it loses contact with the ground control station, things like this. And then finally, the declarations. And the declarations is basically that you affirm that you are not operating it for hire purposes, you're not operating it outside the COA itself, and so forth. So some of the restrictions, line of sight is basically the biggest one within a COA. So an aircraft that, you know, these quadcopters that you see, most of them will have about a half mile to a three-quarter mile. That's your maximum distance, because you have to be able to see it to see if another airplane's coming, so you can maneuver it out of the way. The only other way around that is to have either chase aircraft, or there's some other ways you can do it as well to get longer distances. With a chase aircraft, you have to stay within a mile of it. You can go pretty much anywhere at that point. Airspace restrictions. If I'm in the mode C veil, which is basically an altitude transponder coding system that manned aircraft use, is required within certain airspaces. And then finally, the certificates. When I'm in the certificates, it can change. If I'm going to operate an unmanned vehicle below 400 feet within line of sight, the FAA has kind of loosened up the reins a little bit and basically said, okay, It requires two operators. It requires a pilot and it requires an observer. The pilot doesn't have to be, all they have to do is have a written private pilot exam passed. They don't actually have to have a private pilot license with the practical exam flying the airplane as well. And then the observer and the pilot have to have FAA Class 3 medicals, which is a pretty standard medical. If I'm going to go above 400 feet, now the pilot has to be a private pilot certified pilot. And both the observer and the pilot have to have a Class 2 medical, which basically the only difference is the requirement of 20/20 vision. And it can be correctable. So how can I get around the codes if I'm not a university, if I'm not whatever? So the FAA has come up with Exemption 333. Exemption 333 still requires you have a COA, but you don't have to have an airworthiness certificate, so that takes away the public part. And Exemption 333 allows for higher operations. So we've seen a couple of these be issued in the last couple months. Some for the film industry has gotten Exemption 333s for their unmanned aerial vehicles. If you ever watch Gold Rush or any of these Discovery Channel programs, there's all these cool shots all the time at treetop level or around their sluice and stuff. That's all UAVs. And so the movie industry was pushing very hard to get that. The test sites, we heard in that mandate in the 2012 Act, was to have at least 6 test sites around the United States. So we have 3 in Oregon under the single veil of Alaska's test site. So you can operate within those test sites for a fee for commercial purposes. One of the bigger ones in Northeast Oregon is Pendleton, which they have quite a bit of agriculture under, and some of our extension centers sit under as well. Just a quick plug there. So UAVs and ag. I have to go back one. I presented this slide a couple weeks ago at a presentation, and unfortunately the farmer over there on the left, I had the stereotypical farmer with the pitchfork and the pilot and the uniform and everything. Some guy came up afterwards and he goes, you know, that's so stereotypical. He got very upset about it. So I just changed the picture. So, you know, the picture's changed. It's a good, it's just a grower now. So why are UAVs right for agriculture? Frequent revisit rates. Could you imagine what it would cost a manned aircraft to revisit your field? Or your fields on an everyday basis. Higher resolution. We can easily get within 2 centimeter GSD pixels with unmanned aircraft. And some of the speakers coming up will go into some of that imagery as well. Versus at a satellite level, 3 to 5 meter resolution. At a manned aircraft level, usually around 1 to 2 meter resolution. Low cost operation. Some of the operations are low cost, depending on the vehicles you choose, the sensors you're operating, you know, things like that. Might be just another tool for the grower. So how do UAVs fit in? So I view this in a military level. Satellites are very strategic. I'm going to get some information. I want to know at a very high level, at a very granular pixel width, what's happening within the field. Some of the services provided now on a good year, I might get 3 or 4 overflights within that satellite coverage that might apply to my fields. But this is changing with some of the newer options, some of the satellite options that are coming about. On an aircraft level, it's a reconnaissance and operations level. So it's more, okay, now I'm getting down to, is my field sick? And what can I do with this? Where the UAVs fit in is it's a tool of the grower or the crop consultant or the field agronomist. It's on a very tactical level. Now I know my field's sick. What's it sick with? Or where do I need to go to get to find out? That's where they fit in. And so we're seeing a lot of services kind of pop up around that point. Let's go fly the field real quick, get a micro view of what's happening within the field. So a lot of the problems for commercial use for UAVs, the data itself, is it calibrated? We've seen a lot. I can go out and get a Red Edge NDVI camera that for $1,000 does a great job, but is it calibrated? Is the pictures I took to last week versus this week, are they normalized? No. So where is the data? How good is the data we're getting? The data processing itself. So as I mentioned earlier, over 3,000 pictures in one pivot field, just the amount of data processing it takes, even if you want to mosaic them, not only just to go through them all to find out what's going on within the imagery, even if it's just near IR. So what's the right data to provide? What do you give a grower? What do you give an agronomist? Are they looking for NDVI? Are they looking for RGB, red, you know, normal pictures, what we call happy snaps? Or are they looking for spectrally analyzed pictures? What's the right data to provide them? Do I give them thermal IR where I can look at tiling? So how to present the data in a useful form? Are there APIs, are there applications that actually make this data in a useful form today? This is going to be one of the growing pains that I think we're seeing, even in the big data world of taking implement data and presenting it to a grower, whether that be yield data, planting data, or so forth. The operational standards are going to be a growing pain. Should a crop agronomist or a field agronomist, consultant, what have you, should he have to have a private pilot's license to go out and actually fly a field for a grower? Or will there be separate regulations for a benign environment that the FAA can issue, like we saw with light sport aircraft or so forth? Finally, connectivity. Connectivity is a big issue. We've all heard fiber to the farm. How do we get this data where it needs to go in the processing power? I've heard a lot about Amazon server systems and things like that, but at the end of the day, a lot of this data has to be moved. Is that putting it in a FedEx box and sending it off for next day air, or doing a red box style? I don't know. We'll have to see. So at the end of the day, I wonder if this is legal for me to be doing this. The farmer questions himself. At the end of the day, it's not legal. Because of the for-hire operations, even if I'm doing it on my own farm, for my own purposes, I'm still making a dime off that crop. AUVSI has come out and said if it's going on your tax returns as a business expense, that's business purpose. The FAA came out about a year ago and said, we're fine with a grower going out, having his own UAV and flying it for hobby purposes. That took about a month, and then the head of the FAA UAS program office, Jim Williams, came out and squashed that real quick. It is for, even though you're not specifically, I'm flying it for myself, nobody's paying me to fly it, they're still paying you for the field and the crop that you're growing. And so that's where at the end of the day we have to get the next step of how do we integrate these things in the national airspace, especially within an agriculture environment, because that's where probably the biggest use for this technology is. I don't know if I have any more time. Okay.
Including questions.
Including? All right, I'm stopping there. Yes, sir.
Do UAV have the register?
Sorry, could you?
Microphone.
Sorry, it's a live viewing, so they want you to talk on the microphone.
Does FAA require that UAVs have registration numbers?
By the end of the year, they will. Right now, if you have a COA for any aircraft, you have up until the end of the year to actually register it with N numbers. It's basically like a license plate for an aircraft. And if you're applying for any new COAs, they're requiring before you even apply for a new COA, you have to have an N number. You have to have a registration for that aircraft. Yes, sir.
Two questions. First, I recently heard somebody estimate it was going to take the FAA another 5 years to finalize their legislation. Is that a reasonable estimate?
Well, when I got into when I went to Kansas State to help start the UAS program in 2009, 2010 they were supposed to come out with the NPRM for small unmanned vehicles. It's been pushed every year since then. The mandate is by the end of this year they're supposed to, from Congress, and they've actually said they'll probably push that again because of safety issues, or not of privacy issues. My estimate is within the next 2 years, hopefully.
Okay, thank you. The second one concerned the use of tethered quadcopters. Mm-hmm. I was surprised because I've seen journal articles that said we found that the only legal way we could test our quadcopter was with a tether, and I sent in a request for clarification from FAA because I'm a federal employee,
mm-hmm.
And they said no, tethered ones are also considered. So even if you have a power supply, the thing would drop like a stone if the tether broke. Instead, it's still a UAV.
The funny part about that is it depends on who your letter got to. Some will say yes, some will say no. We've at the University of Colorado, we've done very high altitude kites. I mean, 18,000 feet, and the FAA had no issue with. And at low altitudes, it all depends on the FISDO. Your local FAA department is really what it depends on. You're going to have to come up to the mic, sorry. One of you, sorry.
Good afternoon, I'm from the University of Florida, and my question is, what is the minimum size of a farm in terms of acres where you think a drone would be financially feasible to implement for things such as pesticide application and fertilization?
So actually using it as an aerial applicator or using it just for remote sensing?
Well, for remote sensing.
Like for remote sensing, I think any size farm. Because the way I view it is almost in a co-op sense, that a lot of the smaller growers can utilize one system and basically share the system throughout. So I think that you can go into the lower cost systems where, you know, even on a couple hundred acre farm, it makes sense if you're utilizing it with other growers within your area. As far as in applications, that I'm not even going to get into.
You have UVID and imaging and stuff, but thank you.
You're welcome. Yes, sir. So right now there's the ARC for small rulemaking, for small UAS, 55, the FAA actually hasn't ever said 55 pounds and under UAVs, but that's kind of where their line is to issue the notice for proposed rulemaking sometime by the end of this year. It's probably going to be pushed to next year. At that point, the FAA has a set period of time, usually 90 days to take in public comment, and then 6 months from then, to be able to adjust what their proposed rule is at that point.
Yes, that comes back to the Jimmy's test, if you're a farmer, obviously you're following the EMA rule, then if you think this or not, you not sell the picture, then it's okay. So right now, it's okay.
Yes,
okay.
It is. It's, are you asking, is it still okay?
Yeah.
No, it is not okay.
they've
come back and said no, that they're not okay. So the Parker Supreme Court ruling kind of really screwed a lot of that up, and the FAA basically shut everything down at that point and said even if you are your own grower and you're doing it for hobby purposes, if you're using that imagery to grow a crop that you're selling at the end of the day, it's a business purpose. I'm sorry. If you're selling the crop. It's a gray area. I'm not saying you're going to get enforced on, but I'm saying what their stance is, the latest stance right now.
So I apologize if this is the beginning of your talk, but what about university property to follow UAVs?
So
for research purposes.
So you can utilize the COA program, the Certificate of Authorization program, and I can discuss that with you here quite a bit.
provide stuff for researchers who are aware that they have colleagues within their institutions or adjacent institutions who bought planes or flying them and putting the results on posters?
I don't want to say turn a blind eye to it, because I'm a former test pilot for multiple defense companies, and I still fly airplanes, so I like to keep within the rules, but I saw a lot of that while I was at Kansas State, see a lot of it now out in the Northwest. I would just advise them as a public agency, you have to fly this under a COA. I wouldn't be turning them into the FAA or anything, but that's what I would do.
Hello. So many times you've told us that to get a COA, you need some kind of pilot's certificate.
Mm-hmm.
Could you explain a little bit more about what that entails?
So if you're staying under 400 feet, all you need is a private written. Have passed a private written exam, and that written exam is about 50 questions. It would be like going to ground school for a private pilot's license. So you would attend a course or take one of the video courses for the private pilot ground course. So that entails knowing weather, knowing airspace, aerodynamics, weight and balance, and so forth, and actually going to an exam center and taking a test and having passed it. Now, if you're going above 400 feet, and there are certain cases when you're below it as well, depending on the circumstances, but for generalities, going above 400 feet requires that you have a private pilot certificate. So you actually have to have passed not only the written, but passed the oral exam and the practical exam and be a certified private pilot. And then, as I mentioned, the medical, third class medical with under 400 feet, second class above 400 feet.
Thank you. Are there any online questions? No, there are no. Okay. Well, then let's give a round of applause to George.